book of Isaiah, and I'll remind you that we're now looking at how Isaiah deals with different types of messages. And I decided to start off with the narrative history, partly because that makes it easier to put a lot of other things into place. In our last class, I did a not very good job of trying to give you an overview, and I mentioned a chapter from a book that does a better job, so I went ahead and made copies. So you'll find that hopefully somewhere near where you're sitting. I would encourage you to try to make time to read it, because it would help give you that overview, and you're going to have some time perhaps sitting in a car or an airplane or something on your way to the feast. That might be a good time, but feel free to go home tonight and immediately immerse yourself in this if you like. Okay, so with that in mind, we're moving on. I mentioned that it's a coincidence that we move right on from chapter 6 into chapter 7, but the contents of chapters 7 and 8 really do deal with a lot with the history. And we broke off in the middle of a thought last time. We were at chapter 7, verse 14, which is a famous prophecy. If you remember, God sent a message to King Ahaz of Judah saying, look, don't call to Assyria for help. He's making the case you should be looking to me, to God, for help. And I'll deliver you from this combination of Israel and Syria who are coming to try and defeat you and throw you off the throne and replace you. So trust me, I'll save you and I'll give you a sign. Ahaz doesn't want to ask for a sign. And I said, Ahaz doesn't want to trust God. He wants to trust his alliance with another nation. And God says, man, you're wearing me out. You won't ask for a sign here, I'll give you one. And that's where we get to verse 14. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. The old King James says a virgin, but actually the Hebrew does say the virgin, which implies that it's a particular one that they should know. But it doesn't mention anywhere in this text who it is or which one. But it's worth noting the Hebrew that's translated virgin is halma. And the point is, it can indeed mean a virgin, meaning, in this context, it would be a young, unmarried woman who hasn't had relations with a man. But it's also to just translate it as a young woman. That's also a proper use of that term. So it could be a young woman who is married and who has been with her husband. And if that's the case, it gives a thought that maybe when it says the virgin or the young woman, some scholars have speculated that for the first interpretation of this prophecy that happened then in their lives, it might actually be referring to Isaiah's wife conceived and had a son that they named Emmanuel. One of the reasons for bringing that up is God had Isaiah name his sons unusual names to show what he was doing. We already met Shear Jashub, which means a remnant shall return. We're going to meet Meher Shaul al-Hashbaz, one of my favorite Hebrew names. So it's possible Emmanuel, which means God with us, the Emmanuel of that time, of the time of Isaiah and King Ahaz, might have been a son of Isaiah. It might have been a son of someone else, but the idea is a young woman at that time gave birth to someone named Emmanuel. But we should not forget that this is obviously, we know from what the New Testament tells us, this is also a messianic prophecy of the only actual virgin, meaning a woman who's never had sexual relations, to get pregnant and have a son. And what happened, of course, was Mary became pregnant by the power of the Holy Spirit, and God the Father, you know, caused her to be pregnant with the one who would become Jesus Christ. And it cites that prophecy in Matthew 1, verses 22 to 23. So when I'm talking about the early fulfillment of this prophecy, please don't think that I'm not aware or I'm trying to overlook that the ultimate fulfillment, that this is a prophecy of Jesus Christ and is very unique, the very unique circumstances by which he was born. But it does, you know, the earlier fulfillment fits into the history of this time. And, okay, so we have this. So somebody, perhaps Mrs. Isaiah, will have this son call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. And it goes on to say, curds and honey he'll eat. And We'll talk about that in a bit, but before he knows to refuse the evil and choose the good, before he knows to, this is verse 16, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. The Lord will bring the king of Assyria on you and your people. And basically, this is a prophecy saying that before this child that's going to be born is old enough to know right from wrong, so it's in a short time, the present danger presented by this alliance of Syria and Israel is going to be taken away. So Ahaz, you're so worried about this invading army, God's saying, I'm going to take care of it. Before this child that'll be born can even know right from wrong, I'm going to remove that. And he goes on to show that it's going to come from this army of Assyria coming in. So verse 18, God goes to show, I'm going to call in other nations. Said, the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the farthest part of the rivers of Egypt. As far as I know, Egypt only has one river, but if you've looked at a map, the river, the Nile River, branches out into a bunch of mouths that empty into the Mediterranean. It's called the Delta. So the rivers of Egypt is referring to that. So God is going to call from there. He's going to call, verse 20, with a hired razor, those from beyond the river with the king of Assyria. Basically saying God is going to do his work through existing nations. He's not going to bring in an army of angels to defeat these invaders. He's going to use nations that exist. And I like this. It's like when he says he'll whistle, it's like when you whistle for your dog, you know, and it comes running. That's how God is going to be with these other nations' armies that he'll call in. There's a bit of a play on words where he says hired razor from beyond the river. I mentioned the river usually means the river Euphrates, and that's the case here. But we have here, remember, we're dealing with Israel here, so he's going to call on this nation. He's going to call on a nation clear past the river Euphrates, and they're hired in a double sense. One is Ahaz wanted to hire them to come and save him, but God is going to say, I'm going to take over, and they're going to work for me. So God is saying, I'm going to take care. I'm going to solve your problem. He goes on to describe things in verse 21. In that day, a man will keep a cow and two sheep. From an abundance of milk they'll give. He'll eat curds and honey. Well, earlier he talked about this Emmanuel eating curds and honey. So he's talking about at that time. That might refer to the fact that there are going to be invading armies. What happens when you mobilize your men into an army and another army comes in? You don't have people planting crops. That's one of the problems. One of the reasons there's often famine when there's warfare is armies fighting sort of prevents raising crops and harvesting them. What you have then is land is left for just wild plants to grow. So you're going to rely on your livestock. Okay, we still got the cows. I couldn't plant wheat and corn, but the cows are eating the pasture. We're getting the milk and we're making curds like cheese, cottage cheese. Oh, and because of all this overgrowth of wildflowers, the bees are going crazy and we can get honey. So we don't have wheat and corn, but we got curds and honey. That's what we have to live on. It's not as much a sign of luxury and wealth as, okay, this is what we've got left. That's what we're living on. But that's going to be the state. And it goes on in verse 23 and 24, sort of showing that the crops, things aren't doing so good. You know, where there were 1,000 vine worth 1,000 shekels of silver, it's briars and thorns because of these invading armies. So the aftermath of these invading armies, partly because the king of Judah is looking for alliances instead of trusting God, is they have armies come in and it causes them problems. Let's move into verse 8. Moreover, so continuing this line of thought, the Lord said to me, not to me, Frank, but to Isaiah, take a large scroll and write on it with a men's pen concerning Maher-Shalal-Hash-Baz. Get used to that name. It shows up a lot. It's partly just because I like it. So this is part of his prophecy. Maher-Shalal-Hash-Baz is going to be another son of Isaiah. And the Hebrew means hasten, pray, hurry, booty. That's why it's such a long name. It basically means, and that's not booty as in, disco and shake your booty, but as in pirates taking a plunder, that kind of booty. Well, it's sort of the Hebrews. It's like, hasten to the prey. Let's hurry up and get that prey. Let's hurry and take the booty. So it's like, yeah, he's naming his son with a name that reflects the fact that invading armies will come. And these invading armies that Ahaz invites in aren't going to be friendly. They're going to take Judah's prey and Judah's booty as... I know, okay, Judah's plunder. Maybe I'll use that word. Okay, so that's going to happen. And okay, so God is having Isaiah name his sons particular names to reflect the prophecy. It says, I'll take a faithful witness to record. So Isaiah is going to get a witness. It says Uriah the priest and Zechariah. It's worth noting, this is an aside, but we see elsewhere that, you know, Uriah the priest isn't a good friend of Isaiah's. They're not on good terms, but he's going to have him witness that before it happened, God told them what would happen. So it's sort of evidence. Hey, God predicted this. It's happening the way God planned. So we've got these witnesses. Then I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and bore a son. And God said, call his name Maher-shalal Hash-Baz. And before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father, my mother, the riches of Damascus, the spoil of Samaria will be taken away before the king of Assyria. So this matches what we said about Emmanuel. Okay, before this kid's a few years old can learn to talk, the Assyrian army is going to come and defeat Syria and Israel. And that's what Maher-shalal Hash-Baz is about. Who is this prophetess? We believe, and I believe, that it's Isaiah's wife. That's who he's going into and having a son by. It's worth asking the question, there are some Bible scholars that don't believe that God really inspired the Bible and that it's all the authoritative word of God, who would say, oh, this is temple prostitution, which pagan religions had. A lot of false religions, as part of their religious system, would be you go to the temple and have sex with this woman who's a pagan, priestess, and that's how you worship that god, which that was popular with certain men in the community, but it's not popular with God. That's not what Isaiah is doing. And I'm making the point, no, when it says the prophetess, we think that's the woman that's married to the prophet. This is the only place in the Bible where we see the term used that way. It's enough to make some people question, well, did God sometimes communicate through Mrs. Isaiah? You know, if a prophet is someone who brings God's message, maybe she was a prophetess in her own right. If so, though, she didn't leave a written record. So we don't have we have a book of Isaiah, we don't have a book of Mrs. Isaiah. And the reason I keep using that term is we don't know her name, it's not recorded. But we think this is what happened. So we have this, and he goes, they have this son, and there's that message. Going on to verse 6, continuing to fill out this message, as much as these people, that's the Jewish people, refuse the waters of Shiloah that flow softly, and they rejoice in reason, Remaliah's son. Now therefore, behold, the Lord brings up over them the waters of the river, strong and mighty. This is a bit of imagery and poetry. The waters of Shiloah represent a spring and a stream that flowed from it at the base of Jerusalem. So it's a local stream that's gentle. And the waters of Shiloah sometimes were a symbol of the house of David. So instead of relying on the king I gave you, they're looking to the waters of the river over to the Euphrates. And some people say in this case, maybe it refers to the Tigris, because the Tigris was a rougher river, and that's where Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, was located on there. In either case, it's like, yeah, you're not looking to me, God. You're not looking to the dynasty, the king I gave you. Instead, you're looking over to, I should be pointing this way. You know, you're looking over there to these guys to save you. And guess what? They're coming. But it's not going to be the good result that you hope. And that's what would happen. Yeah, Assyria will come, and they'll defeat Syria. They'll defeat Israel. And they'll go on to conquer most of Judah and put them under tribute. And God will be saying, look, if you'd just listened to me in the first place, I would have taken care of your problem, and you wouldn't have the Assyrians coming and devastating your land and taking your riches and all that. Okay, so this happens. In verse 8 also, it says, he'll pass through Judah, overflow. This is the image of this water, like these armies. It'll reach up to the neck, stretching out the wings. We'll fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. up to the neck, you know, if you've been in water up to your neck, you know, okay, I can still breathe. I'm not drowning. This might represent the fact that the armies of Assyria did conquer pretty much all of Judah, but not Jerusalem. At one point, they'll be around Jerusalem, but God will prevent the Assyrian armies from conquering Jerusalem. Why? Because God is with us. God was with them, and he let it only go up to the neck and then recede. So yeah, the Assyrian army is going to come and cause this trouble, but Judah, they're not going to conquer you. God's with you. I want to move ahead to, there's some good language in this, actually. But yeah, verses 9 and 10, it talks about take counsel together, it'll come to nothing. Regardless of the enemy's best efforts, they're not going to accomplish what they want. They won't conquer God's people. Instead, God will intervene. Kira?
With that, would this kind of be saying, like, if you took it as an end-time prophecy, that God won't let all men die?
I'm not sure if that's his meaning here, but that's the case, and so maybe that is built into that. Yeah, we know, and that's sort of the message that's built into the name of Shear Jashub, a remnant shall return. You know, it's what I call the great Yet-I promise. Yet, you know, I'll destroy you, yet I will bring back a few. There will always be that few that survive. So some of you are chuckling. You might have, if you've heard of the Yet-I, I'll introduce him a little later. Okay, so, you know, God is saying to look to God for deliverance, as in verse 13, the Lord of hosts, him you shall hallow. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. Okay, don't look to Assyria. Don't look to other nations. God might today tell the United States, don't look to NATO. Don't build up your army. Turn to God and he'll take care of you. He's the one that would be your true protector. And verse 14 is saying that he, God, will be a sanctuary, but a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both houses of Israel. God is the true protector. And in some cases, this seems to relate to Jesus Christ. For those who won't believe, he was the stone of stumbling. There's several scriptures in the New Testament that refer to him that way. Matthew 21, verse 44 is one of those. Matthew 21, 44. Let me give you a couple others because it's a recurring quote of this. Also Romans 9, 33 and 1 Peter 2, verses 7 and 8. So yeah, he can be your rock, your shelter, your protection. But if you don't understand and don't obey, then God is like a stone of stumbling. You trip over him, you know, because you're not in alignment with him. And that's specifically looking to Jesus Christ. Many would stumble. And it says both houses of Israel. There it's referring to the nation of Judah and the nation of Israel. And that makes us think long term, not just to that day and time necessarily. Here, and now we move into some scriptures I've quoted in earlier classes, talking about the authority of the Bible and the test of if someone is a true prophet. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. This could be referring to Isaiah's disciples. He might have some prophets in training at the time, but if we look long term, this seems to be perhaps looking to Christians. And we've said perhaps even a prophecy that Christians would complete the canonization of the Bible. I made that case that could be what this is prophesying in our orientation to the Bible class. You know, seal up the testimony could also be translated as finish up and bind. So you wrap it all up. And Isaiah goes on, I'll wait on the Eternal who hides his face from the house of Jacob. I'll hope in him. Isaiah's doing this. And verse 18, Isaiah seems to be saying, Here I am, and the children whom the Lord has given me, we are for signs and wonders in Israel. So Isaiah is saying, me and my sons, we're a sign to Israel, perhaps partly because of these weird names they had. You know, Isaiah's name means Yahweh is salvation, or the eternal God brings salvation. That was Isaiah's name. He had a son whose name was Meir Shalal Hashbaz. Hurry and get the prey. Hurry and take the plunder. But you could say Shear Jashub, a remnant shall return. Everyone won't be destroyed because Emmanuel. God is with us. You see, the names of Isaiah and his sons are portraying some of the message of God for his people back then and for us today. All these still apply. We could say, okay, You know, remember what we learned during the Feast of Trumpets. Mayor Shalal Hashbaz. There's going to be plagues. There's going to be armies fighting. But we don't have to fear. You know, a remnant will always survive. God is with us. And he will establish his kingdom. So that's what makes sometimes the prophets are kind of fun, because you see these kind of messages come through. He goes on, the rest of this chapter, we've quoted, you know, they say to you, go to those who are mediums and wizards. You know, go to those foreign prophets, go to wizards, try to get some truth. And the answer is, well, should they seek the dead? Should you go to a seance trying to contact someone? No. Verse 20, to the law and the testimony. If they don't speak according to this word, there's no light in them. The law, usually we say, refers to the Pentateuch, the Torah. The testimony could be all the rest of God's word, in a sense. At the time Isaiah's writing, that's pretty much what you had. But he's sort of showing the test of a person's value as a prophet or a teacher consists in how much they teach according to the law and the testimony. And you've heard me say that in this room before, and I'll probably say it again. You know, you could tie this to Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 3. In Deuteronomy 13, 1 through 3, Moses, near the end of his life, is telling the people of Israel, look, if a prophet comes and he works signs and wonders and miracles, but then he says, let's go worship other gods, don't listen to him. God is just testing you. Doing miracles is not the proof that someone is a true messenger of God. He's saying the proof is, do they teach according to God's word? So that's the law and the testimony. And the difference, the contrast between those who uphold God's word and those who are against it is like the contrast between light and dark. If they don't live by God's word, there's no light in them. You know, and I'd say if I ever stop teaching according to God's word, I won't have any light. And I wouldn't want people to listen to me. I mean, I would at the time, because I'd be corrupted and trying to deceive people, but I hope and pray that never happens, you know, but that applies to anyone. Okay, and at the end of the chapter, verse 22, they'll look on the earth, see trouble, darkness, gloom, anguish. They'll be driven into darkness. You know, people will be left in utter distress, and sometimes people in that state will curse God and curse his true teachers rather than accept personal responsibility. So you see this important message, these messages that apply to us and to life in general, caught up in a portion of Israel and Judah's history, because God sent a prophet to explain what was going on. I'm pausing because here's where we take the first jump, still focusing on history, but I want to move ahead in the book of Isaiah to chapter 36. So we're going to look at a different portion of narrative history. And as I mentioned, chapters 36, 37, 38, and 39 are historical chapters. Some scholars think that this was an appendix or sort of a wrap-up to Isaiah's early writing. If you remember the theory of the partition theory, that maybe even a different person wrote the first part of Isaiah, they would say, okay, chapters 1 through 35 were that first person's work, and then he added those four chapters as a summary. The rest of the book kicks in later. I don't think the partition theory is correct, but I do think Isaiah might have wrote those chapters at an earlier stage of his life, and then God inspired other things later, and maybe with some slightly different writing style. So we're moving to this period, starting in chapter 36, and this is going to describe the invasion of the Assyrian army, which was prophesied. We just read some of the prophecies that, hey, they're coming. They're going to go up to the neck. They're going to cause devastation. Okay, then it's going to happen. You can read other historical accounts of this in two other books. In 2 Kings, chapters 18 through 20, this is described. And in some places, it's word for word the same. That was 2 Kings chapters 18, 19, and 20. And then also 2 Chronicles chapter 32. So now, though, we're not, remember, we were dealing with King Ahaz back in chapter 7 and 8. Now we're moving forward in time to Ahaz's son, Hezekiah. Hezekiah was one of the kings that we call in general a good king. He tried to destroy, you know, idol worship and cut down some of the groves and the false temples and things and focus people on obeying God. This is a time of unrest. As I said, Assyria has dominance and they've extended their power and influence, so the small nations here by the Mediterranean are almost all sending tribute. So most of them haven't been conquered and had their people taken away. I say most of them, although Israel, the northern kingdom, will have that happen. But at first, you know, they're saying, look, you send us money and we'll leave you alone, almost like a protection racket. Okay, that was the case under, remember, good King Sargon. Maybe he wasn't a good king, but I like the name. Sargon was a tough character, and people didn't dare rebel when he was king. But then he died, his son comes to the throne, and they're watching, what's this Sennacherib going to be like? And they probably said, Sennacherib. Huh, that's a funny name, Sennacherib. I mean, you know, maybe they didn't do that, because... So when Sennacherib comes to the throne, Hezekiah sees an opportunity and he stops sending tribute money. Says, hey, forget this, I'm going to trust God. But he doesn't trust God entirely. Unfortunately, he's also saying, hey, Egypt is getting its act together. Maybe we'll form an alliance with them against those guys. And some of the other small nations are joining in doing that. So with that in mind, in 712 BC, Sennacherib sends his armies and invades. Okay, Sennacherib's only been king of Assyria for 3 years. Hezekiah has been king of Judah for 14 years. Sennacherib overruns Syria, destroys them, goes down the coast, conquers the Phoenician cities, and he's besieging and defeating the Philistines, and he overruns a lot of Israel. There's different Israelites or Jewish cities that it's worth noting. Well, Jerusalem is here. I'm looking for Lachish. It's important because the Assyrian army will conquer most of the cities and they'll be besieging Lachish, and they'll send a messenger up to Jerusalem with a small force, and that's where we join in chapter 36. They've come into Judah. They've conquered much of it. And Jerusalem, they close the gates, they're under siege. Nobody's coming in, no one's going out. So we see here in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, I'm reading in chapter 36, verse 1, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, comes against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them, all except a couple. The king of Assyria sent the Rabshakeh with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah. So the main army is at Lachish, but Sennacherib says, okay, what's his name, Rabshakeh? Take some of the men and go up to Jerusalem and scare the stuff out of them. You know, tell them what's going to happen. It's worth noting Rab seems to have been a title of some authority. Rab, because you see Rabshakeh. Later you'll see Rab Saris. So it's like almost the equivalent of chief. Chief Shaki, Chief Saris, Chief whatever. So Rab is just a title, the various Rabs. So I said, they're at Lachish, to the southwest of Jerusalem. They send this chief with some troops, and he comes up, you know, and he stands by the aqueduct. So he's down at the bottom of the wall, and of course, he can't send them an email or call them on the phone, so he stands there and starts shouting, and there are officials there to hear his message. I'm sure he's got banners and all this, and it's very official looking. Verse 3, you see Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household. We'll see him mentioned in another prophecy. Eliakim was sort of the overseer, maybe like prime minister or steward. And there's some other guys there. Shebna the scribe, Joah the son of Asaph. In the 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 18 account, it says they called to Hezekiah. So it's not clear, is Hezekiah there listening? It seems that he's listening, but he's not there in sight, maybe. But this Rabshakeh starts shouting out his message. Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king. Who's the great king? The king of Assyria. So that's another way of saying the emperor. He's a king over kings. So he's calling himself the great king. What confidence is this in which you trust? So he starts calling him out. You speak of having plans for war? That's just words. So Rabshakeh is now ready to trash talk. Think of basketball players before a game and they start trash-talking each other. It's kind of like that, only a little more serious. One thing he says, verse 6, look, you're trusting the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it'll pierce his hand. So he's saying, you're leaning on Egypt for help, but it's like leaning on a cane that's defective, like it's corrupt, and when you lean on it, it'll break, and the shards will go into your hand. So that's not going to help you, he's saying. That's trouble. In verse 7, if you say, well, we trust the Lord our God, that's the Yahweh, the YHWH. But he's saying, well, isn't that the one whose high places and altars Hezekiah has taken away? Well, no, Hezekiah didn't take away the true God's altars. He took away the false gods. But the Assyrians can't tell the difference. So what's happening is this guy, he thinks they're taking away the altars to the God they worship. Well, what was really happening is Hezekiah was focusing on worshiping the real God. It's just the Assyrians, as I said, they couldn't tell the difference. But it's basically saying, okay, you guys are without help. So trash talk goes on in verse 8. Now they're, give a pledge to my master. I'll give you 2,000 horses if you can put riders on them. He's saying, I don't think you could even raise 2,000 men to come fight against us, much less defeat our whole army. So he's boasting, lying. Verse 10 says, have I come up now without the Lord against this land? The Lord said to me, go up and destroy it. Now, do you think God really sent a message to Sennacherib or Rabshakeh? I don't think so. I think he's just full of hot air. He's saying, hell, you trust in God, God's on my side now. What do you think of that? Well, we'll see. Hezekiah knows better. Hezekiah's not fooled at all. This guy's just trash-talking. It's not going to stand up. Okay, then Eliakim, finally the Jews get to answer. Eliakim and Shebna said, listen, talk to us in Aramaic. Don't speak to us in Hebrew. So Aramaic at that time is what we call the lingua franca. I spent some time in the New Testament saying Greek became the international language. At this point in history, Aramaic is the international language, and Eliakim and Shebna say, talk to us in that language, not in Hebrew. We don't want these soldiers listening to this stuff you're saying because they're going to pee their pants for fear. At least that's what, you know, the answer is from Rabshakeh. My master didn't come just to tell me to speak to you and you and you. He wants everyone to hear this. And he says in a more formal language, so the men who will eat and drink their own waste with you. Basically, I want everybody to hear this, so they're going to be so scared they're going to soil their pants. Okay. And so Rabshakeh, verse 13, he calls out, he says all these things. Don't let Hezekiah deceive you. He's not going to deliver you. He's making you trust in the Eternal. The Eternal will deliver you. That's not going to happen. Don't listen to Hezekiah, he says in verse 16. Make peace with me by a present, meaning give me a little bribe, and I'll let you off, and then you can come out. The siege will be over. You can eat, go to your land. Until then, we come with the army and take you away. Yes, Justin?
Who or what is the Rabshakeh? Did I miss that?
He's basically some military chief. It's some office, like he's the general. I was saying Rab means like chief or general, and then Shakeh might be his personal name. So yeah, Rabshakeh, we don't know exactly who he is, but he's like General Patton coming, or I think General MacArthur at the end of World War II, who makes the Japanese come and sign the peace treaty. That's just off the top of my head. It might not be the best example. But what he's describing here was the practice that the Assyrians and later the Babylonians did have. Once they conquered a people, they would load them up and ship them out, those that were still alive, and make them live somewhere else, and make people from somewhere else come and live in their land. So he's describing what we know as historical practice right here. And he's saying, you know, don't think, you know, any of the no God is going to protect you. Verse 19, where are the gods of Harmath and Arpad, the gods of Sepharvaim? Said, these other nations had gods that they thought would protect them. What happened to them? We kicked their butts. Well, it doesn't say that in Isaiah 36, but not in those words. So he's saying, your gods know better than their gods. But that's where we know something he didn't know, right? Their gods weren't any better than any other nation's gods, but the Eternal One, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, was not like those gods. He actually was and is the real God. Okay, so in verse 20, when he says, who among the gods of these lands have delivered their countries from my hand, that the Eternal should deliver Jerusalem? He doesn't know the difference. He's going to learn. Verse 21, they held their peace, meaning Eliakim, Shebna, and all the soldiers. They let this guy shout and blaspheme and trash talk. And other than saying, hey, talk to us in Aramaic, they kept quiet. They didn't answer. They didn't say, oh, you're wrong. They just let him talk. Doesn't matter. And then they go and report to Hezekiah. You know, they come with their clothes torn, so there's a mark of mourning because they realize we're in deep doo-doo. We're in trouble. The Assyrians mean business. They want to kill us. And so they are in a mark of mourning. They go to Hezekiah and deliver the message. Verse 37, or chapter 37. When Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth. So it's partly because they're scared, but also Hezekiah is realizing, I've got to go humbly to God. There's nothing that's going to save us now except the true God. So Hezekiah is humbly appealing to God. He's putting on sackcloth. He's got ashes on his head, and he's going to go to God. So he sends Eliakim and Shebna, go talk to Isaiah the prophet. You know, it's known that Isaiah talks to God. God uses him as a prophet. And say, you know, this is a day of trouble and rebuke and blasphemy. He's speaking in poetic language. The children have come to birth, and there's no strength to bring them forth. It's like, we're in trouble, and we can't get out of this. Verse 4, it may be that the Lord your God will hear the words of Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, sent to reproach the living God and will rebuke the words. So he's saying, look, he's insulting God. Isaiah, let God know this. Maybe God will take care of it. So Hezekiah handles this properly. In verse 5, the servants of the king came to Isaiah, and Isaiah already had God's answer. This is pretty cool. Isaiah says, go tell your master, go tell Hezekiah, don't be afraid of this stuff you've heard from the king of Assyria. Yeah, he's blaspheming me, God. Look, I'm going to send a spirit on him. He'll hear a rumor and leave. I'll cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. God's saying, he's going to be killed, and he's going to turn and leave. You don't have to worry about it. It's going to be taken care of. And it turns out in verse 8, the Rabshakeh returned. So he comes, and the small force shouts up the message. Then he gets a message, hey, the Sennacherib's leaving Lachish. You got to go join him. What happened, remember, they're besieging. That's why I was looking to see if Lachish is on this, but it's over here somewhere. And they find out Jerusalem's here, they're down here, and said, there's an army coming up from Egypt. We got to leave the siege and go face this army. And so that's what they do. Rabshakeh goes to join the rest of the army, and they're marching off against the Egyptians. But he's not done trash-talking yet. He writes a letter as a message to send back to Hezekiah. So that's what we'll read. At the end of verse 9, when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah. So he sends a message. He's like, I'm leaving, but I'm going to let you know I'm coming back. Thus speak to Hezekiah, don't let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying Jerusalem won't be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. So part of me, knowing that this is the real God, he's saying, don't believe God. I'm going to kick his butt. And you imagine what God is thinking? Who do you think you are, bud? You know, maybe I shouldn't put it in this colloquial language, but you could see God is like, you're saying don't trust God. He can't save you. So he goes on and repeats some of what we read earlier in chapter 36. I won't repeat all of it, but it's all written in this message, which Hezekiah takes. He gets it. He reads it. And verse 14, he went up to the house of the Eternal. He goes to the temple, it says, and he spread it before God. So Hezekiah reads it, and it's very insulting to God. Hezekiah says, God, look at this. He goes in there, you know, and there's a good example for us to follow in this. And you might well have heard this in sermons before. I know I have. When we have a very severe problem, we can go before God. We can't go into the temple because it's destroyed, but we can go on our knees in prayer before the throne of God and lay it out before him and say, God, look at this. These people are insulting you. In some cases, they're insulting your way of life, your law. Don't let this stand. God, I'm in your hands. Please take care of me. Please help me. Isaiah did that. You know, he laid it out before God, humbled himself. He's the king, and he's on his knees there. And it's a pretty eloquent prayer in verse 16. O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God, you alone of all the kingdoms. You made heaven and earth. So listen, God, open your eyes. Hear what Sennacherib has sent, reproaching the living God. Yeah, sure, the kings of Assyria laid waste to all the nations and lands and threw their gods in the fire, but they weren't gods. They were just idols made with men's hands, made out of wood and stone. That's why they could destroy them. Now I'm in verse 20. Now therefore, O Lord our God, save us from his hand, that all kingdoms may know that you are the eternal, you alone. And God sends a message. Isaiah, the son of Amos, sent to Hezekiah saying, God says, because you've prayed to me against Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, this is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning him. So we see in poetic form God's answer to Sennacherib and to Rabshakeh. It says, the daughter of Zion has laughed you to scorn. Yeah, you think you can destroy? I'm laughing at you. And it's portrayed as a daughter, a virgin. Some would say that's representing, that Jerusalem had never been conquered, never been violated by foreign troops. And it says, okay, yeah, you've destroyed these other armies. They weren't God. You know, sure, you did all that. In verse 26, didn't you hear long ago that I made it? I formed it. I brought it to pass. Verse 27, therefore their inhabitants had little power. They were dismayed and confounded. They're as grass. They're just human. So God is making a point. Yeah, you were able to do what you did because you weren't fighting against me. Now it's a different story. And he sort of makes it known when saying, I made it from ancient times. God has been using Assyria to accomplish his will. And God will say that very clearly in some other places. You might make a note to reference Isaiah chapter 10, verse 5. I won't turn there, but Isaiah 10, 5 is where God calls Assyria the rod of mine anger, which I like. God's saying Assyria is just like a tool in my hand, and I can use it to punish people. The example I like to make of that is, we don't use this so much anymore, but we still do. When Connor was little, my family believes in corporal punishment. We think it should be used in measure and discretion. But when Connor got a certain age, we had a wooden spoon that we called the no-no spoon. So when we say no-no, if you don't listen to no-no, the spoon will teach you. So when I said, Connor, I'm going to get the no-no spoon. So Assyria was the no-no spoon in God's hand, so to speak, the rod of his anger. And we'll see throughout the book of Isaiah, he'll refer to using that. Later on, Babylon would become the no-no spoon. So anyways, he goes on poetically. So God's message addresses Sennacherib and what he's going to do to them. Now, in verse 30, he gives a message to Hezekiah. Showing God has said, look, I'm going to send them out. You'll be defeated. Hezekiah, this will be a sign to you. You'll eat this year such as grows of itself, the second year what springs of the same. This seemed to be saying, okay, it's too late now to plant, but you're going to have enough food to live. Next year you'll plant and you'll have enough, you'll grow enough food to get you by. So God said, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to make the crops abound. And he goes on, the remnant who have escaped the house of Judah will take root downward, bear fruit upward. So though, Sennacherib conquered much of Judah, but those who are left are going to reestablish themselves. The nation of Judah won't be defeated or destroyed. Okay, and that's what happens. Oh, I skipped over something. Oh, yeah. I missed one of God's messages to Assyria, where he says, I'll put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips. God's saying, look, I'm going to treat you like an animal. I'll stick a hook in your nose and lead you around. And there's some irony in that, because that is something the Assyrians did to their captives. They would literally hook their noses, and when they're taking people into slavery, lead them that way. And so God is saying, that stuff you've been doing to your slaves, I'm doing to you, Buster. I'm going to stick my hook in your nose and lead you away. So God speaks very strongly. Sennacherib and Rabshakeh can trash talk, but God could trash talk right back. Only with God, it's not trash talk. It reminds me, Babe Ruth famously said, it ain't bragging if you can do it. And with God, it's kind of like, God's not bragging. He can do these things, and he does. And God says, getting back to the message, verse 33, concerning the king of Assyria, he won't come to the city or shoot an arrow here. So he never does bring his army against Jerusalem. Remember, they marched away to face the Egyptians, and it's over there somewhere they would have this disaster happen. And we see that in verse 36. The angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000 men. When the people arose in the morning, there were the corpses all dead. And I really miss, if you read this in the old King James, it says, when they woke up in the morning, they were all dead. Which I imagine you wake up and go, oh man, we're dead. I was going to get up and go fight a battle, but I can't because I'm dead. And like I said, the English is kind of funny. But the idea is God destroyed a huge portion of them. And interestingly, the Egyptians, they're going to face the Egyptians. The Egyptians think, hey, our God defeated the Assyrians. The Egyptians give credit to their gods, which it wasn't the case. It was the true God. But this is true. You know, they never did come back and fight Jerusalem. Some scholars look for ways to explain how this happened. I've read some accounts saying, well, maybe some bad virus came in the camp and killed a bunch of them. I've read some say maybe a lightning strike came and killed a bunch of them. I think it was an angel that came and killed a bunch of people. That's what the Bible says. I don't have any reason to doubt. So that happens, and they withdraw. And we finish the story. Verse 37, Sennacherib departed, went and returned home at Nineveh. It came to pass, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, his sons Adrammelech and Sharezer struck him down with a sword and escaped to the land of Arad Esarhaddon. What this doesn't tell us is we believe that probably happened about 20 years later. So it wasn't that he went home and next week his sons killed him, but it would happen. And we'll see a reference to Esarhaddon in Ezra chapter 4 and verse 2. Reason I want to mention this is Assyria doesn't conquer Judah, but they do put Judah under tribute again. And Hezekiah's son Manasseh would pay tribute to Assyria and later be punished by them. Okay, I know the bell just rang. I just want to wrap this up. I'm not going to go through chapters 38 and 39 because they're very self-explanatory. Although it's worth noting the story about messengers coming from Babylon when Hezekiah was sick. Remember, Babylon had been conquered by Assyria, but were trying to throw them off, so they're friendly to Judah. Hey, you're fighting against my enemy. And then God gives this prophecy, these guys you think are your friends, later on, they'll be the ones to conquer Judah. But we're going to move from there. Next time, we'll move on to the next type of message of Isaiah. And I'll just save that and describe it when we get there next time.